From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The world is learning the answer to yesterday's question, who is George Papadopoulos? The 30-year-old former Trump campaign foreign policy advisor, so green he included Model UN on his resume, pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russians. That was revealed as the indictments against former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort and his deputy Rick Gates were announced yesterday. They pled not guilty to charges of conspiracy and money laundering and are under house arrest. White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders says Papadopoulos was just a volunteer. But last year, then-candidate Trump tweeted a picture of a meeting including Trump, Papadopoulos, and Jeff Sessions. And the Washington Post recorded candidate Trump in March of 2016, just after he made Papadopoulos an advisor.
George Papadopoulos, he's an oil and energy consultant. Excellent guy.
The Washington Post's Philip Bump joins us. And Philip, you write Post reporters questioned Trump about Papadopoulos' credentials right then. Give us the timeline. The week after Papadopoulos is named advisor in 2016, he heads to Italy, where he meets a professor based in London. Who is he?
Our reporting suggests that it's a gentleman named Joseph Massoud, who is the director of the London Academy of Diplomacy and who has ties to Russian government officials and other Russian actors.
And according to Papadopoulos, this professor becomes interested in him when he learns that he is now a member of the Trump campaign and offers him what?
He offers to start making some connections. And so he introduces him to a woman who claims to be the niece of Vladimir Putin. They have some email exchanges. But more importantly, he introduces him to a gentleman who has ties to the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And that person actually then conducts a series of conversations over Skype and email with Papadopoulos over the course of the next several weeks and months, with the putative rationale being that Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin might meet at some point over the course of the campaign.
And what was the reaction from the Trump campaign?
So Papadopoulos raises this several times. He raises it over email. He raises it actually in a meeting with that Donald Trump attended along with his future Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and says, "I have connections that can actually connect Putin and Trump." The basic reaction from the campaign is that they are disinterested. There is one advisor who is a former Rear Admiral in the Navy who warns that this is, you know, there are potential legal consequences to this, this sort of backdoor diplomacy. And we know that in May, when it's raised again, then campaign chairman Paul Manafort sort of says, hey, no, we shouldn't move forward with Trump meeting Putin, but maybe there's a lower level person that can do this so it attracts less interest.
Well, there's another thread here in which the Russians tell Papadopoulos that they have dirt on Hillary Clinton, that, as he writes in an email, they have thousands of Clinton's emails.
Right.
This is in April. And we know that WikiLeaks begins releasing emails from the DNC in July, you know, months later. Talk about the disconnect there.
So this is actually well before the public knew that there were emails that had been stolen from the DNC or emails that had been stolen from Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta. And so this suggests that the Russians were, while they had these emails in hand, because they had started hacking Podesta in March, they had started hacking the DNC, according to government intelligence sources, as early as the summer of 2015. They had these emails in hand, and they were already starting to shop this around.
So this is Papadopoulos talking about Russians wanting to give him dirt on Clinton,
right,
months before other members of the Trump campaign took meetings with Russians who wanted to give them dirt on Hillary Clinton.
That's right. So this predates by about a month and a half the outreach that was done to Donald Trump Jr., which ended up resulting in that early June meeting in Trump Tower that included Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner. There certainly seems to be a pattern of the Russians reaching out to the Trump campaign to try and offer them dirt on Clinton.
Well, and does this necessarily mean that people on the Trump campaign knew that Russians were behind the hacking of several Democratic accounts?
It doesn't necessarily mean that, no. We don't know the extent to which Papadopoulos told others on the campaign about the conversations he'd had with the Russians. Again, it certainly shows a pattern of what the Russians were trying to do, whether or not, based on what we know now, the Trump campaign was aware of it.
Well, and we should just note that Trump campaign supporter Roger Stone was tweeting out these mysterious messages that there were things that were going to happen. Donald Trump himself said something about, you know, maybe the Russians should get her emails. So that has certainly raised suspicions on the part of many people. But when do we come to Papadopoulos lying?
As the government is starting to investigate Russian meddling in the 2016 election, the FBI sits down and interviews Papadopoulos in January of this year. During that interview, Papadopoulos claims that he met the professor before he knew he was working with the campaign. And as the timeline we just articulated shows, that's not true. So the FBI actually arrests him in July and then apparently gets him to admit that he had lied to them and then uses him as a witness. They probe him for information, and there's some reporting that suggests he actually may have worn a wire to record calls with others on the Trump campaign or others who, you know, remain nameless at this point.
What are you hearing is happening inside the Trump White House at the prospect that there was someone who might have been working with the FBI in the last couple months?
White House staff are sort of shell-shocked. Obviously, President Trump was not happy with what happened yesterday morning. And one of the things that's remarkable about what happened yesterday is that we learned that the special counsel's team had kept private the fact that this guy was one of their witnesses. And so there are potentially a lot more of these sorts of bombshells that are already in play that people aren't aware of.
Philip Bump, national correspondent for The Washington Post, will post your timeline at hearandnow.org. Philip, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, today, lawyers from Google, Twitter, and Facebook are testifying before Congress, talking about how much of a role they may have played in allowing Russia to spread false information in the U.S. Facebook is expected to say that Russian-linked content reached as many as 126 million people on its platform during the election. Other countries are facing similar threats from Russia, but are responding in different ways. In France, President Emmanuel Macron was the object of Russian interference, but it didn't work. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joins us from Paris. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, Jeremy.
And tell us what happened with Macron.
So, candidate Macron was hacked a few times by the Russians, most notably between the first and final rounds of voting, which pitted Emmanuel Macron against Marine Le Pen. She was the far-right candidate, and she was the favorite of the Kremlin. So the day before the Sunday vote, a trove of his campaign emails were released on the web. But it basically had no effect, Jeremy, because under French law, there's a 48-hour blackout period. The media weren't even talking about it, and nobody even knew about it. But I spoke with Nicholas Tenzer, who runs a think tank on cybersecurity, and he said hacking was not Macron's biggest problem. He said there was another way in which Russia worked to derail his candidacy. Here he is.
Which is, of course, all the fake news spreading out about Macron himself, about his private life, with a lot of fake stories about, you know, he was gay, about these sort of things, about his banking accounts, and all those were completely fake news.
So Russia was basically trying to say that Macron was a rich gay playboy to detract from his message.
So did that work?
You know, that didn't work either. And I asked Mr. Tenzer, are French voters smarter than American? And he said, no, not at all. But those stories didn't get traction either because they were ignored by the mainstream media. So they spread on sort of far right and far left conspiracy type sites, read by people who wouldn't have voted for Macron anyway. Macron eventually barred journalists from Russian state media, Russia Today and Sputnik, from his press events. He said they were acting not as news sites, but as propaganda sites spreading lies. And as you know, Facebook and Twitter have just banned ads from those two so-called news outlets.
So what else is France doing to try to fight these fake stories planted by the Russians?
Well, you know, there are laws in France and other European countries like Germany that means that the internet is more closely watched, like hate speech laws, and you cannot deny the Holocaust. So there's no freedom of speech here if you're saying hateful things about, you know, a group of people. French law has forced Twitter to take down posts and even shut down sites under this law. And France also has laws about advertising on the web. So, in fact, internet advertisers have signed a charter with the French government where they promise to only advertise on legal sites and not those that, for example, pirate films or music. That's how it began. But it could also mean fake Russian, you know, research sites, for example. And there's a mechanism that alerts advertisers to sites that aren't valid. So that's increased surveillance a bit, too.
And what about those websites that you mentioned that aren't made up, but they're closer to propaganda, things like Russia's RT website? What has Europe done about sites like that?
Well, that's exactly the problem. You know, they're not outright fake news all the time. They report solid news on many issues, but then on others, they claim to offer an alternative view. And Tenzer called this soft propaganda, which he said is actually spread through legitimate journalists or politicians or opinion makers who may be sympathetic to Russia. And here he is.
For instance, you had a lot of people when it comes to Russia saying, well, we have to understand the Russians and the Russian spirit and Russians have always been humiliated since centuries, and you have to understand their resentment and don't blame Putin too much, because we could have worse than Putin. That's what I call soft propaganda.
So Tinzer told me what's really needed are teams of people, cells, working around the clock to debunk, you know, fake news and theories. It does exist in small doses. For example, newspaper Le Monde has a fact-checking whole unit that flags fake news and tracks down sources. But Tinzer says overall France is not doing enough about this. And he says France and Germany really got lucky in their elections this time around, but this problem isn't going away.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joining us from Paris. Eleanor, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
It's here and now. One of my favorite parts of Halloween is the scary CD. You hide some speakers out on the leaves, let it waft over the block. But you could also play the works of French composers from the 1800s. That's Camille Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre, Dance of Death, about the legend of death rising from his bed at midnight on Halloween, summoning skeletons from the grave. Then there's this one. Paul Dukas's Sorcerer's Apprentice, made famous by the Disney film Fantasia. And how about a little Hector Berlioz? Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, which includes an execution and a witch's Sabbath. Fran Hoffner is classical music columnist for The All. She joins us every now and then to talk classical music. Hi, Fran. Happy Halloween.
Thank you, Robin. Same to you.
And start with a very, very scary story of Hector Berlioz. Let's listen. Think that you hear this sometimes on those scary CDs that you can buy.
Definitely.
In the background. It's apparently a tune of a traditional funeral chant. It goes back to medieval times.
Mm-hmm.
About a witch's Sabbath? Tell us more.
Yeah, so Symphonie Fantastique was the first sort of programmatic piece of music, as in when audience members showed up to the concert, they were given a program about what the symphony was about. It's in five movements, and it basically details the failed love affair of its hero, maybe about Berlioz, maybe not.
Well, we want to take that up. By the way, though, these are real bells that are used on stage. This is a recording from Leonard Bernstein and the French National Orchestra. So very cool there to have some real bells. But you say maybe Berlioz's story, maybe not. Let's go with that it is, because that's just so much better.
Of course.
He was a love-struck young man obsessed with a Shakespearean actress he saw on stage. And apparently the symphony was his attempt to impress her. Let's just listen to a little bit. Yeah. So he sent the actress tickets to the premiere. She didn't go. And so then this symphony becomes the story of an artist going off the rails?
Yeah, essentially. And he winds up marrying a different woman who was his big fan, who just went on and said nasty things about said Shakespearean actress in order to garner his favor, as you do.
Well, but let's talk about the fourth movement, the artist's march to the scaffold. It's an opium-induced dream.
Yeah, about one's own execution.
Well, how weird. And this is after murdering his beloved. I mean, this is a scary symphony. According to a PBS piece on this piece, Berlioz did take opium. That's how he got the actress to marry him. And then he took an antidote. I mean, this is crazy. But in the symphony, in the telling of this story, this artist thinks of his beloved as his head is chopped off. Let's listen. Oh, boy. this didn't go over well, we understand, in 1830.
No, it kind of freaked people out, which is understandable. I think it's still a little freaky now.
But, well, and tell us more about Berlioz's music. Was this common for him?
I mean, he was pretty experimental at the time. I think he liked to draw on a lot of tone poems and these a little more like fantastic ideas. And while that might have seemed sort of old hat by the end of the 18th century, he's sort of writing, you know, 50 years before Saint-Saëns.
Well, as we mentioned, he did get the actress to marry him. They separated, but they are buried together in Montmartre Cemetery in Paris. So there's
how
the
romantic.
Yes, right. There's the story of that. And then there's Camille Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre. It starts with a harp mimicking the stroke of midnight. Then death appears in the form of a solo violin playing tritones. Let's listen. Fran, your thought on those tritones we just heard, those screechy things.
Well, those are meant to symbolize the devil.
Yeah, they're used to convey evil in Western music. One's called Diabolus in Musica, or Devil in the Music. Then we have skeletons that join the dance of death. Let's listen.
And this was the first use of xylophone in Western classical music.
Really?
Yeah, it had been used in Eastern music for a while, but this is the first time it appeared, and I think it had a very realistic, rattling sound to it at the time that probably spooked people.
And it gets wilder and wilder.
Yeah.
An oboe comes in to mimic a rooster crowing at daybreak. Tell us a little bit more about Saint-Saëns.
Saint-Saëns was a very popular and fairly traditional French romantic composer during this time. He was experimenting with the types of programmatic music that Berlioz had sort of set him up to write. So it's a pretty experimental work based on a poem by Henri Cazalès about, you know, an old French superstition about the devil essentially coming to life at midnight on Halloween and bringing all his skeletons with him.
Yeah. What was going on in France that they had all this scary music? Do you know?
a pretty tumultuous 19th century, I would say, politically, that maybe would drudge up some death.
Here's some of the poem. Zig, 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 death in cadence, striking a tomb with his heel. Death at midnight plays a dance tune, zig, zig, zag on his violin. The winter wind blows and the night is dark. Moans are heard in the linden trees. White skeletons pass through their gloom, running and leaping in their shrouds. Okay, so that's pretty scary right there. And I also think I hear this one on some of those Halloween CDs that they put out. That's Paul Dukas's Sorcerer's Apprentice. This is, of course, from Fantasia. Describe what's happening. You can probably picture it. I can picture it. What's happening in the film while this music's playing?
So in the film, it is our sweet friend Mickey Mouse, who doesn't want to do his chores for the wizard, I believe it is. So he uses the wizard's magic to command a broom to do his sweeping and cleaning up for him, but it gets out of hand.
And the brooms multiply.
The brooms multiply and flood the place.
Yeah, and this, I use this as an image, and I, you know, a lot of people don't remember it anymore, but this is how I feel when there's too many emails or too much. It's the brooms and the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, the piece loses control of itself very quickly in a really fun and spooky way.
Tell us more about Dukas.
Dukas was a late Romantic, early modern French composer. You know, Fantasia comes out in 1940, I think, and this piece comes in 1897. So really not that much of a time difference between these two things. And he had only died just recently before Fantasia came out.
So we will have all this scary music posted for you at hereandnow.org. Maybe have these on your speakers tonight. And I want to go out with the other one from Fantasia that people usually think about when they think of scary music, Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain. Your thoughts on this?
Still too scary for me to listen to.
Okay, well, bye-bye. Fran Hoffner writes about classical music for The All. Fran, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Trump is expected to announce his pick to lead the Federal Reserve before he leaves on a 12-day trip to Asia at the end of this week. Janet Yellen has been Fed chair since January 2014, but her term expires early next year. Yellen could be renominated, but reports this week indicate that instead the president will pick Jerome Powell, who's been a Fed governor since 2012. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, welcome.
Hey, Jeremy. Good to talk to you again.
And what should we know about Jerome Powell?
Well, he's a Republican. He's got deep roots in the party establishment and in the financial industry, but he has steadily supported Janet Yellen's approach to both monetary policy and regulation. So it wouldn't be expected to be a philosophical switch from Yellen. It is highly unusual for a Fed chair not to be renewed for her second term or their second term. So that would be a first for Janet Yellen. And frankly, this comes down to the fact that Donald Trump has said that he wants less regulation. Janet Yellen hasn't agreed with that. She feels that even though the economy is largely recovered, it still needs regulation. And Powell has said, and most recently in an October 5th speech, that more regulation is not the best answer to every problem. So that's what it comes down to.
So Powell is likely to be with Trump on the question of regulation.
Yeah, that's really the area of difference. There's another sort of thing, and that was while the campaign was going on, President Trump was very critical of Janet Yellen and the Fed's policy of keeping interest rates, in his words, artificially low. He said that was helping fellow Democrat Obama and President Obama at the time and Hillary Clinton, who was running. Janet Yellen's a Democrat. The fact is, President Trump is now enjoying the fruits of those low interest rates in the way the markets are reacting. That's an outcome of having low interest rates because people don't have another option for investing. So it's not clear that the president wants the Fed chair to increase interest rates, but he does want to pull back on regulation.
I saw a bit of an interview that President Trump did with Lou Dobbs on Fox Business last week, in which the president actually asked Lou Dobbs who he should pick to be the Fed chair. And Dobbs said, I would keep Janet Yellen. The president said, well, you like to make your own mark. So is that what this
right.
is about?
That's very much. And you can see this throughout the administration, right? There's nobody with Barack Obama's imprint right. Going to stay in any part of the administration. But the Fed is a different body. It is not an agency of the administration. It's not an agency of the executive. So it's not typical for a president to do this midterm. In the end, it's not clear what the policy changes will be for average Americans because Powell is likely to do exactly what Yellen was doing.
Is Powell going to be raising interest rates at the same pace as Yellen?
You know, it's a very, very, very slow pace. He has proposed that the central bank should adopt a rule, basically a mathematical formula to guide the movement of the interest rate. But in the end result would probably be something very, very similar. A slow, slow, slow move upward, which will slowly start to, you know, even out the stock market as well.
And Ali, we just want to correct one thing, which is that there is one member of the administration who did stay under Trump after President Obama, and that's the VA Secretary David Shulkin.
That is true.
The one Democrat in the cabinet.
Yes.
All right, Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Thank you.
All right.
Perhaps you've read Helen McDonald's award-winning 2015 bestseller, H is for Hawk. If not, do, right now. She writes in the most lyrical prose about how after the death, way too young, of her beloved father, a noted photographer, she retreated from the world into the world of Mabel the Goshawk. We read, holding our breath, as Mabel learns to jump onto Helen's fist, then fly to it, finally to fly, hunt, and will she return? Yes. We marvel at Mabel's beauty and her hunting skills. At one point, Helen describes her as 30 ounces of death in a feathered jacket. We get to know Mabel so well that when we learned, spoiler alert, that Mabel died of a fungus infection, we grieved and wondered if Helen would ever train another bird. The answer is yes, and you can watch her do it in the PBS Nature special, H is for Hawk, a new chapter. We meet Lupin, the new goshawk Helen will train, and get a rare opportunity to accompany Helen as she observes goshawk chicks in the wild. H is for Hawk, a new chapter, premieres tomorrow, and Helen McDonald joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Helen, so great to speak with you again.
It's just a joy. Hello.
Hello. Well, and to see this, what is it about these goshawks? We see you observing them at one point, and you say it makes the room that you're in with them feel wild. What is it about these creatures?
They're just transformative. I describe them at one point, I think, as a cross between a leopard and a dragon. Mm-hmm. You know, they're these creatures from myth wrought into, you know, bones and feathers with these staring orange eyes and talons. I mean, they're as near to a dragon as you can get in real life. And yeah, as soon as you bring a goshawk into a room, the room stops being a domestic space and becomes somewhere much colder and wilder.
Yeah, you talk about their predatory grace, big, bloody, scary, hard to see in the wild. And we're thinking that when we met you and Mabel, it feels now, seeing this, you know, new program years on, that you are a different person then. You felt like a hawk then, a little closed down, a little, you know, hooded eyes, dark forests, you know. you feel different now. Is that accurate, do you think?
Oh, so much, so much. So people sometimes have read my book and they meet me and I can see the fear in their eyes as they come up to me as if, you know, I'm this kind of terrifyingly dark and gothic creature. I'm really not like that, you know. I like to think I'm a kind of a soft and fluffy creature these days. So one of the things that was interesting about going on to train another goshawk was, you know, I'm this new person. I'm full of sunlight and, you know, hello trees, hello sky. You know, what was it going to be like to find myself back in the presence of one of these dark kind of creatures? And the answer was, it was awesome.
Because why?
I think it was a reckoning. So falconry is a really strange dance of trust between you and a wild creature, and you develop a relationship slowly over many, you know, days and weeks of contact. And Lupin and I sort of came together and we developed this friendship that was of a very, very different kind of tenor than me and Mabel. You know, Mabel and me were like, she felt like part of my soul. I mean, that seems really cheesy now, but Lupin was very self-possessed, and we had this very mature sort of relationship that was like that between two adult colleagues. It was really cool.
Well, it feels like Mabel was enabling you to go to a very dark place of this grief that you had, and it almost feels like with Lupin, you're coaxing her out of that dark place, you know, and into this glorious, you know, life as a trained goshawk in the wild. Let's talk about the training. And it's not just training. You get to meet her because she's bred in captivity by these wonderful hawk people who sit with a bank of television screens and watch their hawks as they breed them.
Oh, it was absolutely hysterical. Yeah, these guys, they just stare at these screens. It's like NASA for hawks. And we watch a male goshawk and a female goshawk doing their business.
Here we are. Come on, look. So you're doing it right there. There you are. That's it. One copulation.
Hopefully she lays soon and it'll be fertile.
It's a just marvellously comedic moment.
That's how Lupin is conceived, and you get to watch her grow. But you also go into the wild with other falconers and get to see chicks in the wild because they are taken out of their nest at a certain point just to be tagged.
Would it stress her out if I just go quickly held her for a second?
No, no, that's fine. That's fine.
Come on then, missus.
What was that like, to hold them as chicks?
Oh. You know, I kind of wish everyone could at some point in their lives hold a baby goshawk. I know that's not very, you know, likely, but if you can imagine holding something made of cotton wool that's also extremely heavy and full of kind of spiky new feathers, and they turn their heads around to look at you and they have this amazing sort of smelling breath. It smells like pepper and hot stone. And they stare right at you. And they look like they're prehistoric, you know. And the thing that was astonishing is, you know, we were banding these birds for science. Then we put them back in their nest. And there was this very poignant, beautiful moment where I realized that no one's ever going to touch these birds again. In fact, they might not even be seen by human eyes again. Mm. But for one brief moment, we managed to, our lives intersected with theirs. It was amazing.
As you say, looking for goshawks in the wild is like looking for grace. It comes, but not often, and you don't get to say when or how. So back to Lupin, who, by the way, Lupin, you say naming hawks, there's some tradition there?
It's a great superstition. So among falconers, if you give hawk a kind of really scary name, like, you know, vampire or slayer, it will do nothing but sit on a fence post and with fluffy feathers and squeak at you. So people tend to give falcons and hawks quite cutesy names. So I called mine Mabel. But Lupin, I think, I was really pleased with this name. It just dropped into my head one day because Lupin obviously means it's a kind of flower, but it also means wolf. And I think there's no better name to conjure those two sides of what a goshawk's like, something which is very predatory and very powerful and wild, but also kind of beautiful and cute at the same time.
Mm. Talk about crossing from, as you say, this world into a wilder one. You're taking Lupin out at this point, trying to train her. You and your friend are training her. You did Mabel alone, but getting her to fly from one of you to the other. You've got her on kind of a leash. She's working towards getting off the leash, which scares the heck out of me, you know. How do you know she would come back?
Well, the process was very different, not just because it was a new hawk and not just because I was a kind of new person, but because it wasn't solitary. And it wasn't solitary partly because my friend was there, but partly also because there was a film crew in the room. Mm. And training a goshawk is stressful, but training one with a bunch of cameramen and sound recordists in the room makes it even more stressful. And there was one really funny moment where we had one of those, you know, those microphones that are covered in fluffy material to stop the wind noise. And the goshawk just suddenly saw it and went into full hunting mode, thinking it was a rabbit of some kind, you know. there was this kind of beautiful sense that here was a very ancient process that was happening. We were training this hawk the way that falconers have trained hawks for, you know, thousands and thousands of years. But there was this extra dimension of warmth and camaraderie and friendship and you know, and the filming crew.
And we thrill and watch as Lupin flies free for the first time.
We have liftoff.
You said it was like a reckoning. It feels like redemptive, too.
Yeah. You know, it's been a long time since the death of my father. And when I was training Lupin, he was kind of conjured for me.
Listen, people believe that. I shared once that we had red-tailed hawks here right in, you know, the middle of the city. And they built a nest on an office building and people would come to watch and they had names. And somebody called to say that her husband had died and he'd been a huge fan of the red-tailed hawk. And the red-tailed hawk showed up at her husband's funeral.
I get a chill down my spine. You would not believe the number of people I've spoken to over the last couple of years who've had experiences almost exactly like that. And you think, you know, for thousands of years, hawks and falcons have been seen as related to the human soul. you know, in Central Asia, there are gravestones with carved images of people on horseback, and above them there's a hawk flying, and that's their soul. It continues through the shamanic traditions, where the falcon or the hawk is often the communication between the person on the ground and, you know, whatever is above. And I think my time with Mabel, you know, was somehow part of that old story. And, you know, they're just strangely special animals.
Yeah. That's naturalist and author and now television star Helen MacDonald. Her new nature special on PBS is H is for Hawk, a new chapter. For more about the PBS special, go to hereandnow.org. Helen, thanks as always.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
News today that Netflix has suspended production on the next season of House of Cards to review the situation with Kevin Spacey. Netflix announced yesterday that it will end its run of House of Cards. The company claims that decision was made months ago, but it was announced following allegations made against House of Cards star Kevin Spacey by actor Anthony Rapp. Rapp said Spacey made an unwanted sexual advance on him at a party in the 1980s when Rapp was just 14 and Spacey was in his mid-20s. This follows other allegations coming out of Hollywood and other industries in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein news. And joining us now is Kim Masters, host of The Business on KCRW and editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
And I'm going to leave aside just for the moment the criticism that Spacey is getting about coming out as gay in the very same statement where he apologizes right. mm-hmm. to Anthony Rapp. Were you surprised that Netflix moved as quickly as it did to end House of Cards and now today we're learning suspend production of the next season?
Well, they said they were in the middle of what would be the final season anyway, but I'm not at all surprised that they have now suspended production. I mean, I from the minute the story broke, I really knew that they're not going to be able to do this. Actors are not going to want to be on set with Kevin Spacey because I think a lot of people feel that this is going to be followed by other allegations, as we saw in an extreme fashion in the Harvey Weinstein case. And I can tell you from my reporting, I think that is likely to be the case and that people kind of know it, as people knew or kind of knew about Harvey Weinstein. So they're just not going to come on set and film the show as if nothing has happened.
Are people, though, making a distinction between the allegations against Harvey Weinstein and the, at this point, one allegation that's public about Kevin Spacey? Or at this point, if you get accused of anything like this, do you become the next Harvey Weinstein?
Well, as I said, you know, there have been rumors around Kevin Spacey, so everybody feels like there could be more. And I can say, based on reporting I've done so far, and none of which I've been able to publish yet, I would say there's reason to have anxiety about what might yet come out. So I think people just are going to back away. And I'm, you know, honestly, look, how should I put this? I would not be shocked if it turned out that this was a pattern of behavior, that there are other people, and that basically we're seeing a version of Harvey Weinstein redux. And I'm talking, you know, even in terms of quite extreme behavior that has been alleged against Harvey, you know, which includes rape. I think we'll see allegations, if my instincts and reporting are right so far, that will also be pretty bad.
Do you think that this would be happening with regards to Kevin Spacey and, by the way, Mark Halperin, the MSNBC political analyst who was fired and after being accused of sexual harassment?
Yeah,
right,
so and so on.
And
yeah.
has lost his job and his book deal and his movie deal. Do you think that these would be happening without what we've learned about Harvey Weinstein?
Not really. I mean, I think it took I think there were elements in the environment. You know, we saw Fox News, we saw Cosby, and we saw Trump in the White House after the Access Hollywood tape. So I think there's been this building, you know, resentment on the part of women who have been victimized and as it turns out, in some cases, men. And so when, you know, this thing happened with Harvey, which I've said in other interviews many times, I think it happened partly because he was no longer at the peak of power. Hmm. And I don't know how it will happen, whether people still in the peak of power will be, you know, exposed if they've done these kinds of things. But, you know, once that dam started to even, you know, open up, that we've seen what has happened. And we've had many women come forward at The Hollywood Reporter writing essays about what has happened to them, things that they've been, you know, keeping secret for years with other people allegedly in, you know, participating in harassment or covering up harassment. It's just like, I think, honestly, the combination of the horrible news about Fox News, Cosby, Trump, all of that, women were just at this point, especially women, where they were ready to say, you know what, I'm just done with this. And then, you know, I'm getting calls and messages literally every day about people. You should look at this person. He did this to me. Look at that person. It's a tricky thing for journalists because, of course, once we make a call, we're starting a ball rolling of potential innuendo about someone who may or may not have done something.
Right.
But on the other hand, if we're brought dark allegations, we can't ignore them.
Well, what does it tell you? You mentioned President Trump and the Access Hollywood tape, and he's been accused of these kinds of things as well. What does it tell you that he is still president of the United States and everybody else we've talked about are or have lost their jobs?
Well, Jeremy, we've also seen allegations of collusion with Russia that are starting to seem awfully convincing. So I like many, am baffled at the lack of consequences for all sorts of behavior in the White House. Maybe we're getting to a point where there will be consequences, not for the being a sexual predator. I mean, there are lots of women who have come out to say they were, you know, groped or whatever by Donald Trump, and he, of course, incriminated himself in this regard. So, you know, we're in a baffling moment of history, and I with a very divided country and a very bizarre moment in American history is all I can, the only thing I can say about it.
Just a few seconds left here, but are you expecting more stars to fall in Hollywood?
I'm thinking stars and executives. I mean, already, you know, our reporting brought down the head of Amazon Studios, Roy Price, for making advances to or to producer on one of their biggest shows,
right.
Man in the High Castle. And I believe if I succeed in what I'm doing right now, there will be more.
Kim Masters at KCRW and The Hollywood Reporter, thank you.
Thank you.